And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, just like the gentleman said. We're going to be speaking to Professor Tiffen Dixon about international law and the what is going on with the case of the president of Ivory Coast, Mr. Gbagbo, as well as other matters, Venezuela in particular. We want to know her views. And, of course, we're going to be talking later to Stephen Gowans at the Halfway Point. Stephen has written a new article at his site, What's Left, titled When Liberal Democracy Means Plutocracy. And, of course, Stephen has also been writing about Venezuela. Venezuela is very much on our mind, so you can assume we're going to touch these matters throughout. But I think we're joined now by Tiffen Dixon. Are you there?
Yes, Phil. Hi.
Well, hi. How are you doing? You are eminently qualified, in my view, to be talking about this problem, the embarrassing situation of the International Criminal Court, which might be a misnomer. I'll ask you about that later. But when we spoke to you, I think maybe 2 weeks ago, perhaps three, and something really dramatic had happened, but it's left everyone scratching their heads. The former president, I shouldn't call him the former, he was the elected president of Ivory Coast, according to the people who counted the ballots, and to the Supreme Court of Ivory Coast. But he was removed from power by external forces and, I would call them, miscreants domestically, and ended up at the tribunal in The Hague, where he spent 7 years, after which time he was acquitted without having to present a defense because, as you told us, no sufficient case was made against him. But he wasn't released, and when we spoke to you last, the question was, so how is it possible he could be acquitted and not released? But, of course, it's a couple of weeks have gone by, and I want you to pick up the story. Where is Mr. Gbagbo, and what is happening with this case?
Well, the answer to where is Mr. Gbagbo is I don't know. We don't know. I haven't found any reliable account of where he is.
Really?
Yes, really. And we don't know where Mr. Blegoudet, youth minister, who was co-accused with Mr. Gbagbo, is either. We know for Mr. Gbagbo that Belgium has offered to host him according to the conditions that the appellate court set out last Friday. We'll get into that.
Okay.
And in the case of Mr. Blegoudet, we understand that no state has offered to host him and abide by the conditions set out by the Court of Appeal. But we don't know where either of these people are. We did see a car taking Mr. Blegoudet away from the jail in The Hague, in Scheveningen, a suburb of The Hague, to what we believe is some hotel in The Hague. There are some assumptions that he's gone to Belgium in the meantime. And of concern is a Belgian journalist who's been covering mostly East Africa, actually Rwanda, Burundi, who's been very pro Kagame. Mm-hmm. And she today has published an article in a Belgian daily, La Libre Belgique, to say that there's a trap awaiting Gbagbo in Belgium, that there's still a criminal case against him pending for something that took place in the year 2000-2001. So I don't know if that's true, but I know that that's been published, and this is the position she's taking a little too joyfully for my taste. So as to where they are, we actually don't know. And if we don't know, it may be attributable to one of the conditions that the Court of Appeal has set out to secure the release of Laurent Gbagbo and Charles Goudet.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I don't want to monologue here, but that condition is pretty astonishing. There are eight conditions all in all, and the seventh says the following. So they're not to make any public statements directly or through any other person that would include a lawyer, I'm assuming, about the case or to be in contact with the public, or to speak to the press concerning the case.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I have to introduce a problem right at the top that was going to naturally flow from a discussion of this case. But There have been, there particularly in Africa, there have been a number of politicians, legal scholars, who said that they the appearance is that the ICC has been its power has been used to take political figures out of circulation. Then we recall the case of Uhuru Kenyatta, who was the elected president of Kenya, and it was a demand was put on him. He had to go to The Hague and defend himself, which damaged the democratic workings of a country that has a parliament, has attorney general, and we look at the Gbagbo case. 7 years, the elected president is certainly. You could debate whether he won or not, but everybody understands that it was a big turnout. It was clearly a democratic contest. And one of the figures in that democratic contest is totally removed from the scene for 7 years. Isn't this manipulation of using the court for a political goal?
I think that's very much the case. And we know that there's some quote unquote diplomatic skullduggery of Luis Moreno Ocampo, the former prosecutor, who was a guy that liked to hang out with Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, and for whom George Clooney bought a drone to supervise or to try to catch genocide in Sudan.
Clooney bought a drone for Ocampo?
Yes, yes.
I hope Ocampo's having to make the payments.
So this was not a serious gentleman, to say the least. And always interested in the limelight, and what better opportunity to, they believe, to burnish the credentials of the ICC in still those early years is to bring another charge against another African leader. And so we know that a former employee of his, she was actually seconded from the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs after she was back in French diplomacy, actually at the UN. There are, thank you, WikiLeaks, cables between her and the office of the prosecutor sort of advising him in how to go about getting Gbagbo to the ICC. And as we discussed last time, it was Gbagbo himself who signed on to the ICC as a result of a coup attempt against him in 2002. Interestingly, just the same as Chavez, the coup in both instances. But after 2003, he had not ratified. I guess he is smart enough, a trained historian, to figure out that it might not be the best idea.
He smelled the rat, as they say.
Yes. to put it succinctly. And ultimately, what Ouattara had to do, and Ouattara was the challenger in the 2010 December 2010 to 2011 elections, was to assert jurisdiction for only the electoral period, so say October 2010 to April 2011, and then subsequently signed on to the ICC.
Now, the population of Ivory Coast has no say in this at all. Right? In other words, their wishes may as well be their voice is muted. The fact that the population, political, actually across the board, some of the old rivals of Gbagbo are saying he should come home. But actually what you describe is a kind of camouflage situation. Actually, we don't even know at this moment where he is. And he's told he can't speak. I probably should remind listeners, you argued in the case, worked on behalf of President Milosevic, and also we were at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. One of the things that was raised by yourself and others was that the intervention by people like Ocampo, but prior to him, Luis Arbour, was they were making political decisions. They were saying, in the case of Mr. Milosevic, that he couldn't be negotiated with because he was a criminal. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right. And this occurs stunningly during the 78-day and night bombing of Yugoslavia by NATO, in complete violation of international law. So there's no Security Council resolution authorizing it. There's no authorization by the state. There's no pretense to it being an Article 5 operation under NATO, i.e. An attack on one of the states, and therefore an action in self-defense. It's none of that. Mm-hmm. And midway through, Luis Arbour brings an indictment against President Milosevic, sitting president of Yugoslavia, being attacked by bombs daily, unlawfully, and says that he is no longer a legitimate interlocutor. Mm-hmm. You know, and having said the day before and the day after, of course, that the office of the prosecutor does not engage in any political action whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Do we know at this point whether the counsel for Mr. Gbagbo are challenging this business about he can't talk, he can't be seen, basically deal with the public, et cetera? Are they viewing that as a separate issue from whether he's released or not?
Well, there hasn't been a peep from them other than Friday night after the decision was rendered in writing, because when it was initially pronounced by the president of the ICC, who's presiding that appeals chamber, Justice Eboyo Suji, he didn't mention the conditions at all. He ordered their release and said that there would be a decision forthcoming in the evening. Mm-hmm. And that decision came quite late, Hague Europe time, and also Ivory Coast time. Mm-hmm. It wasn't clear what those conditions would be. So I have a statement from President Gbagbo's lawyer, Emmanuel Alcid, saying this will be the first night that Gbagbo would spend outside of jail in almost 8 years, because he was arrested by the Ouattara/French/UN authorities in April 2011. Mm-hmm. So he's been detained for longer than 7 years. Uh-huh. And since then, there's been nothing. I checked to see if there were statements from the lawyers, from the defense team of Charles Bligoudé, and similarly, there's nothing. We don't know what their intentions are, and the problem is that I don't see jurisdictionally what's open to them right now. So theoretically, they could apply to vary the conditions of the release. But, I mean, it's quite controversial already that exists. In other words, the Rome Statute is very clear on what happens after an acquittal. Mm-hmm. There's a general rule, and it's released. Obviously, they've been acquitted. Mm-hmm. However, there's a proviso that allows the trial chamber after an acquittal, in exceptional circumstances, and specifying gravity of the offense, flight risk, and probability of the prosecution winning on appeal, to continue detention. That's all there is. Mm-hmm. There is nothing at the acquittal stage that permits a trial court, much less an appellate court, to order release with conditions. Mm-hmm. And what the appellate court did is, first of all, find some credence to the prosecutor's odd argument that there would be a flight risk, and invent a new test. I mean, I don't want to get too technical here, because It's bound to be boring to the layman, but they made something up. They said the trial court should have first asked themselves, since the prosecutor was asking them for the lease with conditions, whether there were compelling reasons not to release them without conditions. Mm-hmm. Now, that exists nowhere in the rule, mm-hmm. in the Rome Statute. That exists nowhere.
Uh-huh.
And then they go on to say the appellate court that the trial court erred in law because they didn't follow this test that the appeal court just invented last Friday.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be exceptional circumstances. Detention?
Yes.
No exceptional circumstances. Release without condition. The Rome Statute doesn't envisage release with conditions after an acquittal. Now, they do refer to other articles in the Rome Statute that discuss pretrial detention,
mm-hmm.
Pretrial release. And, of course, pretrial release might logically have conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But an acquittal?
No, it's...
It's
such an exceptionally bizarre... I there's kind of two or three related questions about this. I want to make sure I ask it. At this point, it's called the International Criminal Court, and you know it has such a luster to have a name like that, and it gets cited all the time. Canada, as a matter of fact, has, I think, asked that Maduro be, or his generals be referred to the International Criminal Court, and it has such a nice ring to it. But isn't it a bit of a misnomer? I mean, people have to be reminded that several of the great powers of the earth say the court doesn't apply to them. I mean, Tony Blair, I think, said it certainly. The United States has made it very clear. It has nothing to do with – the court can never talk about arresting anybody from the United States. And mm-hmm. there's a number – you pointed out, Gbagbo, his government had not ratified. So,
that's right.
In a sense, they're traveling under false pretenses to call themselves the International Criminal Court because an ordinary reader is supposed to understand everybody comes under their purview, but they don't.
Yeah.
But
well,
then
that was –
and then a second aspect, I don't want to pile up the question, but the second aspect of that is, how come Africans seem to be the only people brought in front of this court?
The vexing question. Well, as to the first part of the question, though, the nomenclature of international is more aspirational than real. It was, you know, the early dream, something that, in fact, the commission of jurists at the UN had been working on for decades after Nuremberg. But, you know, clearly after proceedings at Nuremberg and even worse, Tokyo, great powers weren't particularly keen to subject themselves to something that did, like it or not, look a lot like Victor's Justice because it was Victor's Justice.
Mm.
But there was, at the end of the Cold War, and once the two ad hoc tribunals got off the ground, so the ICTY for former Yugoslavia and the ICTR for Rwanda, 1993-1994, you know, enthusiasm is reborn for the idea of not some ad hoc, not some victor's justice, but for something truly global, international, that would hold all states, notwithstanding their power, equally to the law. To international criminal law. What a lovely idea. Of course, this is what I study and this is what I teach. There's no law without politics. So of course the process of drafting, of negotiating the Rome Statute is heavily political.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. participated, had a delegation, and even had a concept of a silver bullet. And that silver bullet was that U.S. service members would be exempt from prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of two things. Either only U.S. service members are exempt from prosecution, in which case this is not a universal tribunal as the dream conceived of it, or it would mean that all service members of all states mm-hmm. subject to the ICC would be held theoretically responsible under the jurisdiction of the ICC. Either way, that wouldn't fly. There's no ICC if service members are exempt globally, and there's no ICC if one state gets to be the exception as it conceives of itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the international notion, I mean, pragmatically, politically, in reality, is a misnomer, clearly. There are three permanent members of the Security Council who do not have, who are not members of the Rome Statute, the ICC. That's China, Russian Federation, the U.S., of course, India, Egypt, Turkey. I mean, there are a number of, and of course, Israel. There are a number of key states, Syria, that have not accepted jurisdiction of the ICC. So you're right, it's not international. Now, the second question is, why is it that there are only Africans that are brought to The Hague? That's a very good question, and it's the vexed one, of course. What the prosecutor of the ICC likes to say, Ms. Fatou Bensouda, don't look at the ICC as targeting Africans. Look at the ICC as protecting and defending the rights of African victims.
Yes, whether they ask for it or not.
That's right. That's right. I mean, some might also argue that it's quote unquote easier to get African accused over to the ICC.
That would
Many
be true
African
here
states,
in our legal culture in the United States. It's very visible.
It is very visible.
We discussed an awful lot the built-in prejudice and assumption and. You know, most likely charged, most likely convicted, most likely to do a long sentence.
Absolutely.
We have an African policy.
And there's also the fact that many African states, in good faith, signed on to the ICC, were early adopters, made what's known in the literature as credible commitments to the ICC.
Well, I really appreciate all that. I realize with my time here, I've got to ask you about the burning question today in Canada. The Lima Group is meeting. It's called the Lima Group in Ottawa. And the government of Canada says that it has recognized a president in Venezuela, a man named Guaido, and they say they don't want to see any bad things happen. They don't want any military action. But I want to know, if you change the president, you've changed the commander-in-chief of the army of Venezuela, who are now, according to Canada, under Mr. Guaido rather than the elected president, Mr. Maduro. Meanwhile, Canada is trying to be mealy-mouthed, unlike Trump, who just says he'll throw him out if he feels like it. But tell us about international law and how it might apply to this situation.
Can I first, pretty please, talk about the Venezuelan Constitution?
you could mention it. By the way, the Prime Minister is an expert on it. He said he found an article in there that says that Guaido is in power. I really doubt it. I don't think the Prime Minister knows as much about international law as you do, so we turn to you rather than him.
I appreciate the deference. I understood from your Minister of Foreign Affairs, Ms. Freeland, that there is, as I suppose the Prime Minister said, a constitutional provision that's supposed to be Article
233.
And what's interesting is there is not a single enumerated reason there that applies to President Maduro. None whatsoever. In fact, we're talking about illness, medical or physical, that was confirmed by the highest tribunal of Venezuela. Absence, departure from office. None of those categories, and all confirmed by the highest tribunal. None of those apply, and it gets very interesting. In terms of having determined that the president of the National Assembly would take power. So assuming for the sake of argument that President Maduro had resigned, been removed from office, physical or mental disability, or had been recalled by popular vote, there are two subparagraphs of the article that say, if the president was unavailable prior to the inauguration, and you know the inauguration took place on January the 10th, so prior to the inauguration, if the president is lawfully removed, which he wasn't, power would revert to the president of the National Assembly. So let's just pretend that there was removal for cause. Well, this was after the inauguration, and what Article 233 of the Venezuelan Constitution says is that after the inauguration, if this occurs, power reverts to the executive vice president. So they don't even have their fake legalism right.
Now, this is, frankly, people kind of see what's going on, but it's just shocking that they try to use this peculiar language. By the way, they talk as though Venezuela does not have a Supreme Court. It has a Supreme Court. The Supreme Court of Venezuela has made some decisions about this assembly to which the young man belongs. I forget his name. Guaido, I guess, but...
Yes, Guaido.
You know, and by the way, how in the world is the Prime Minister of Canada, where does he get off claiming to... He has no authority. This is not his territory. I mean, there is a matter about non-interference in the internal affairs of other countries, by the way. Is there not?
Yeah, that's the UN Charter. It's kind of a cornerstone of the architecture of the UN Charter. It's Article 2, Paragraph 4, that prohibits states from... using force or threat of force for the territorial integrity or the political independence of any state. This is clearly a violation of Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the UN Charter. I mean, not that this has been respected by the U.S. and other Western countries since the inception of the Charter, but it's still a principle, and this is still very much a cornerstone of international law. And, you know, the good conduct of international relations, one would think.
Yes. Well, you know, but a number of foreign ministers, of course, people, the best known one being Mr. Lavrov of Russia, he said, we would like to see a return to the normalization of international law and of procedure. Yes. He said, but we're dealing with a state that just makes declarations that it's going to do this, it's going to do the other thing. It's not, I mean... And unfortunately, Canada seems to be now much more loyal to that, the rogue state approach, than it is to international norms.
Yes, that's true. And certainly, I mean, Foreign Minister Lavrov has had this position consistently for at least 20 years. And the West's conduct is... is going rapidly out of control. To be sure, if you just think of what John Bolton recently said, because this is a sort of collective hysteria, where all these anti-Maduro states are adding fiction. So first there's this constitutional fiction, then there's a sort of fiction that Bolton brings up. That this one Guaido, who's president of the National Assembly that's been held in contempt by the Venezuelan Supreme Court, says that he has ordered an amnesty and that Maduro better take advantage of this amnesty to have a retirement on a nice beach somewhere.
Yes.
And if he doesn't, he'll have to retire on a nice beach called Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah, part of Cuba. And the one that President Obama said he was going to get rid of 10 years ago, and never did. I realize I should ask you about this. This business of using the OAS and the United Nations, but bypassing them, it strikes me that Canada's adopting a new strategy, which is highly destructive of these institutions. Canada only joined the OAS rather late. Now it's formed a faction called the Lima Group. It's not the OAS. It's a faction within the OAS. And then at the United Nations, they are bypassing all the charters and statutes that you've laid out. But it's a highly destructive road.
It really is. And it's reminiscent of the run-up to the invasion in Iraq I noticed that the UN Human Rights Council Special Rapporteur, Alfred de Zayas, who on Venezuela has mentioned it as well, that you have the sanctions regime, and you have this coalition outside international law, outside the UN, that's pushing for regime change, and who knows what comes next. You know, President Donald Trump has said, quote unquote, as always, all options are on the table. So this type of, a faction of the OAS that was never a progressive group in the first place looks suspiciously like George W. Bush's coalition of the willing.
Yeah, it's really...
But completely outside international law, and that is absolutely unlawful.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I could take a better note to close on than that one. Tiffan Dixon, who is an authority on international law and has, better than that, has actually practiced it. We really appreciate your time. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Phil.
Yep. Bye-bye. Bye. This is the Taylor Report, and I have an announcement. We're going to be, by the way, we'll be speaking to Stephen Gowan shortly, but there's going to be a talk in Hamilton Sunday, February 17, 2 p.m. at the Steelworkers Hall. Pardon me, I said Hamilton, didn't I? Well, no, this Toronto, February 17, 2 p.m., Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street. And at Hamilton, Monday, February 18th at 7 p.m., New Vision United Church, that's 24 Main Street, I believe. And the talk is by Mr. Kovalik, U.S. Plot to Control the World. Seems apt, a nice title, U.S. Plot to Control the World. And it's going to be Sunday, February 17, and Monday, February 18. The one on 17th is Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street. The one on Monday, February 18 is 7 p.m., New Vision United Church, 24 Main Street in Hamilton. I think we're going to take a musical break. And we will be back with Stephen Gowans.